ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you have a smartphone, and many of us do, how much time do you spend on it? Or do you close your eyes and go la 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 every time your screen time notifications come up? We know these devices are making us more stressed and eating away at our downtime and possibly even affecting our relationships. But would you ever consider downgrading, going back to the old days of the brick or the flip phone, the dumb phone, if you will? This is a radical lifestyle experiment that some Australians are conducting with interesting results. Let's see if it might work for you on Life Matters. I'm Hilary Harper and we're coming to you from Naarm, Melbourne. Our phones can feel essential to functioning in everyday life right now. Paying for groceries, scanning QR codes, taking photos, banking. I can't remember the last time I left my phone at home, but I do remember the cold sweat that broke out that time that I lost it for a while. And yet problematic smartphone use is being blamed for an increasing loneliness and stress and anxiety, especially among young people. Researchers are divided on how big a problem this is, but anecdotally, many people say they'd like to stop constantly flitting between apps. Could it be as simple as switching to a less tempting device? Rosa Ellen is a voice that you might have heard here at RN on The Arts Show, and she has been using a dumb phone now for 2 months. Rosa, hi.
Hi, Hilary.
What made you decide to do this? Did you have some kind of pivotal moment where you threw your smartphone in a pond or something?
Yeah, I sort of did.
Oh.
But the moment, the events that led up to it is similar, very similar to what you were just mentioning. It was the flitting. I had this, I'd wake up. The first thing I'd do was check my text messages, check my Messenger app to see who'd messaged me. Then I'd probably move over to my personal email. And then while I was at it, I'd kind of be tempted to check my work email, because why not? Because like in another hour, I was about to, face it anyway, and then maybe Instagram, and then I'd scan, emphasis on scan, the news sites, and then I'd go to work, and as we're, most of us are required to in office jobs, I'd be at my desktop computer for a full 7 to 8 hours, and I was flitting between screens. And the overall, I'm lucky enough that I grew up, I'm a millennial, and I did actually experience some of my early adulthood without a phone at all. By the time I was 30, smartphones were ubiquitous. And I kind of calculated that I'd just spent 10 years on screens. And I had this ultimate feeling that I was wasting my precious life.
Wow. And so you got to this point where you thought something has to change.
Yeah.
What has changed since you de-teched a bit and went to a less smartphone?
It was a slow change. A couple of years ago, I bought a dumb phone and I'd take my SIM card out of my smartphone on the weekend and I'd do a bit of a weekend detox. And I'd feel so good afterwards. Like I felt like my neck pain kind of went, and I'd be able to mainly read. I was always a big reader, book reader, and I hated the feeling that I'd have to recalibrate my brain in order to read a still page. And so I was doing that quite a lot. And then gradually, I started to think about how could this be a permanent sort of mode for me. Anyway, over the summer, I was camping and my smartphone broke.
Oh.
Which was the ideal situation, in fact, because then I got out the dumb phone and I was sort of offline. And there's been some hiccups, but it's been very kind of liberating.
Interesting. Well, tell us about the hiccups, because a lot of people will say, but surely there are many, many things that you can't do and that will be horrific in your daily life. Where have the little stumbling blocks been?
The most egregious stumbling block was on the side of the Westgate Freeway in Melbourne. I had a total meltdown because I didn't
have... It's a terrifying place to be.
I didn't have Google Maps. I'd lost my map reading ability. I got an old Melways, so I supposedly had the map out, but I don't know how to do that anymore. So anyway, that was a big stumbling block. The other thing was I'm not being on WhatsApp messaging app. Now that's where most of my friends sort of, contact each other these days. And so I missed someone's birthday. I sort of fell out of contact with a group of friends that I then had to sort of remedy. So yeah, those things
Well, yeah, I mean, technically you can open up some of those messaging apps on your laptop later, but it sounds like you have had a kind of wholesale move away from screens. Have you noticed a difference in the way that you spend your time?
Yeah, I had a period where I read like a lot. I think I, you know, in the first few weeks, I was just getting through a book every day or every couple of days.
Every day?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I was just sort of voracious, and I realized that I'm a bit of a chronic reader, and the phone was the perfect medicine for that. I'd pick up and it didn't really matter what I'd read. It was like reading a cereal box or something. I'd just read what was ever on my phone. And now I was turning to whatever else was within reach, which was like magazines and books. And I have to say that didn't last.
Okay.
Yeah. So that need for sort of entertainment, I sated that, and then I felt a bit bored. And so that was interesting. I'm still in that period. I've been trying to be okay with being bored, and I think that is a bit of a modern conundrum. I've been returning to some hobbies, which include drawing. The number one thing I do feel that has changed in my brain is an ability to concentrate, and I've lost the fear of being out of contact.
That's really interesting, because I wondered if you'd had any anxiety about not being as connected, because I've had these moments where I can't find my phone for a couple of minutes and I freak out. It's like that's really interesting to notice that reaction in myself. But you're saying it's lessened your anxiety overall.
Yeah, it has. That wore off. I mean, people perhaps got a bit used to me being, less lightning quick in my responses. People still send me URLs to things. That's very annoying. Or emojis.
How old-fashioned.
Emojis that I can't read. I just guess from the tone of email.
Can you send me a cat in, like, using punctuation, please?
I still haven't mastered that. That's a lost art.
Do you think that you're going to continue with the dumb phone, Rosa?
Absolutely. I have to come clean about one thing, Hillary. After the Google Maps incident on the Westgate Freeway, I had to find a solution to the fact that I do sometimes need the internet when I'm out and about. And so my solution was I bought a tablet that is Wi-Fi enabled. So sometimes if I'm on a long car trip and I want to listen to a podcast or I need maps, I have that. But I don't take it around with me.
Okay, yeah. It's too big and clunky. Yeah. That's an interesting point. Rosa Ellen, producer of RN's The Art Show, thank you and best of luck.
Thanks.
Fascinating. So is this worth trying for yourself? Jocelyn Brewer is a registered psychologist and runs courses on digital nutrition, which is a philosophy that she developed in her practice. Jocelyn, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you be part of this particular discussion. Mm. And with us too is Brad Ridout, who's an associate professor of cyber psychology at the University of Sydney. Brad, welcome to you.
Hi, Hillary. Great to be here. Looking forward to discussing this very topical topic.
Yes. Well, tell us first, Brad, how do smartphones affect our thinking and about our behaviour? Can we say that they're bad for us overall?
It definitely, anecdotally, especially young people now are identifying that more, that it's increased. They feel like their phones are increasing their stress, anxiety, depression, and even reporting sleep disturbances. And a lot of that can be put down to social media. Social media is the thing that basically draws us in. We spend on average about 5 to 6 hours a day on our smartphone. Probably half of that is on social media, which is way more than people spend, you know, listening to music or podcasts or anything else. So there's a whole heap of reasons why. FOMO is one of the big ones, and just feeling like they need to be connected all day long. And there's just so many things about the social media apps on the smartphone, the notifications probably being the most obvious one, that constantly, you know, are trying to draw us out of our everyday offline life and back into the online life. So, yeah, that can definitely be very stressful and an absolute constant distraction where people are actually, you know, reporting something we're calling variable attention stimulus trait, which is kind of like a culturally induced ADHD.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really starting to affect people's brains in ways that our brains just aren't designed to cope with.
Well, and as you say, you know, those apps and those phones are designed to be sticky and distracting. I was fascinated to hear that Rosa was having less difficulty concentrating now that she's using a so-called dumb phone. And Brad, they affect our cortisol levels too, don't they? I mean, you talked about some of the things that we look at on our phones that aren't great for us, but also the ways we use them. Do they affect our brain chemistry?
The research is yet to kind of determine that scientifically, but we're definitely seeing that doing certain habits like checking work emails, you know, first thing in the morning, as Rosa said, or, you know, last thing at night, can lead to a stress that we're just not used to having and interfere with those natural cortisol rhythms, not to mention our sleep, obviously. You know, the blue light that phones emit affects our sleep and reduces melatonin, which helps us get to sleep. So there are things that you can do. I think most people these days are aware of the night mode and things like that. They can put it in their phone to reduce that. But just not having that switch off that our brains are and usually wired to need in order to get quality sleep can definitely have an impact. But there are things like the addictive design that kind of, you know, just give us little bursts of stress throughout the day that we're not used to having. We're you know, evolved to be able to concentrate on a few things at a time, not 100 things at a time. It's like our brains are used to, as Rosa said, having multiple tabs open in our life. And it's not just when you're sitting down at a computer, it's everywhere, because, you know, your phone is just that whole world in your pocket, and it's constantly beeping at you and wanting your attention. And yeah, it can definitely give you that feeling of stress throughout the day, not to mention the stress of FOMO if you choose to take a break from it.
Yeah. Though it can also tell you who that actor was in that weird, obscure 70s film that you really, really need to know at this particular point in time. We're speaking with Brad Ridout, who's an associate professor of cyber psychology at the University of Sydney, and Jocelyn Brewer, who's a registered psychologist and runs courses on digital nutrition. Jocelyn, from that perspective, what do you think about the dumb phone trend as an antidote to that kind of stress?
I think it's a lovely use of nostalgia. I think we all have that sense of, you know, the evolution of our own use of phones and that slippery slope where, you know, our grasp on attention has really, you know, flitted away and dissolved over probably the last 10 to 15 years. Look, the dumb phone is, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, that's just another way to make money. when we can remove apps, I guess, from our smartphone that are the more distracting ones without losing the convenience. So Rosa, for instance, might just want to remove some of the apps that she does find really tricky to avoid. I personally delete Instagram off my phone from Monday morning to Thursday night, and then I use it over the weekend so I can have that sense of connection with my friends. It sounds too, though, what I thought was really interesting is that Rosa's found JOMO, the joy of missing out, which is something that Christina Crook talks about. So the antidote to FOMO, the fear of missing out, is actually that sense of realizing there's not that much going on, that picking up the phone or, you know, using some of those other, oh my gosh, old school ways, turning up to somebody's house and just knocking on the door. Remember when we used to do that? Could actually, yeah, replace. So very interesting kind of way that we're all adapting to recognizing this massive information overload that we're experiencing.
Though most people I know react with horror to the idea that people might just turn up unannounced at their house on a Sunday and knock on the door. What?
Or call you, right? Like the idea that we used to have one device that could ring at any moment and there could be anyone on the other side was actually used to be really exciting.
Yes, yeah, that was really interesting. A couple of questions come up for me, Jocelyn, in what you've said. Could it put us at a social disadvantage if we don't have that connectability? Rosa was saying, you know, she had to rebuild some friendships at various points when people thought, well, she's not getting back to me, this is bad.
Absolutely. That's a key thing that people report, is that feeling literally of missing out. And FOMO, I reframe often, it's used sort of to make us feel bad for wanting to belong. And belonging and feeling connected is actually a really hardwired part of human experience. So what I suggest people do when they do need to take a little bit of a break, or they need to kind of readjust their relationship to technology and that, you know, urgency response, is to communicate with people exactly what their changes are. Like, hey, I really value our friendship, but I'm not going to be on 17 different apps so you can send me memes at all hours of the day or night. We actually need to find a different, you know, older, maybe going backwards to some degree way to communicate and keep our connections alive. So usually I've got a list of friends actually that are not on social media that I make sure that I'm texting and that I'm kind of including in different ways so that I don't lose that contact, but it takes a bit of effort.
Yeah, I had friends who lived overseas that I would only email before smartphones, and that's kind of died now because there are messaging apps that are cheaper and you can talk to people overseas. And I miss that, really, that long form communication. But Jocelyn, the other thing that occurred to me when you were talking about ways to cut back was that's really hard, that moderation approach. You know, you can delete apps, but you often reinstate them. You might turn off notifications and then wonder what's going on. Is that going to work for people, or do you need to kind of go cold turkey in a sense?
Look, it's horses for courses. There are different personality styles that work better with a complete abstinence approach. And to those people, I salute you. I am much more about that moderation. What we see from the digital detox kind of research is that people can swear off things, they unplug, they go on these really hectic kind of digital diets or yo-yo diets. And because there's that disconnection, which is kind of too overwhelming, people then tend to come back online and binge. So the digital nutrition approach is really about taking stock of how we're feeling and noticing really the physiological responses. Like Brad was saying, that you can almost feel the cortisol and the amygdala hijack that happens when we get overloaded with too much information, as well as the dopamine response of all the rewards of being online as well. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's a one-size-fits-one, and really looking at your own digital diet and thinking about what things are nourishing and feel good to you is really, really important. I talk about the idea that some online activities are kind of like highly processed foods and some are the digital kale, and sitting down and actually considering what things are useful and feel good that have virtual vitamins in them. That's a little activity I do with students that I work with to actually kind of come up with what are these virtual vitamins, then what are the additives in the highly processed kind of foods of the online world.
Well, I love how you talk about the practical things like putting on your digital sunscreen, dealing with your timers and things, being a bit mindful about your use, but also checking in with your responses about whether you feel that things are going well with your use, but also being aware of whether it aligns with your values. And that's really interesting, isn't it? When some of us look at how we're using our devices and work out that it's not how we want to be living our lives and conducting our relationships, isn't it, Jocelyn?
Yeah, that's right. So I talk about the three M's of digital nutrition, which is kind of like apply before scrolling. Before we go out into the sun, we put our sun cream on. Before you go scrolling, I suggest you put the three M's on. And one of the three M's is to have meaning in what you're actually consuming. So, you know, my personal example, I did a big cull of who I was following a couple of weeks ago, and I noticed I was following not one but two dudes who mow lawns and do whippersnippering. And I just had to be like, that was fun for about three videos, but now it's actually just a massive distraction and is taking me away from the stuff that really matters.
Yep.
So, just kind of doing a bit of a cull, realigning to the stuff that's meaningful is really helpful. Being mindful is one of the other M's, and then moderate is the third. So little ways that we can use the technology under our skull to kind of override the very powerful and ubiquitous and, you know, compelling technology in our pocket.
Oh, I'm a bit sad that I might have to stop watching my Japanese competitive bed making videos because they're very calming, but sure, I'll take that on board.
In moderation.
Exactly. We're speaking with Jocelyn Brewer, who's a registered psychologist specialising in digital nutrition, and Brad Ridout, who's an associate professor of cyber psychology at the University of Sydney. And Brad, interesting to note that there was this big uptick in search results for dumb phones over the last few years, but not a lot of uptake. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think that speaks to what Jocelyn was saying about digital detoxes. That kind of was all the rage maybe 5 years ago, and, you know, many people have tried it and realized that it doesn't really work. They do find that people come back and end up binging to catch up on what they missed. So yeah, I can see why there's an interest in that. A lot of pro dumb phone people are not calling them dumb phones, they're calling them intentional phones. So there's phones that, you know, are not just like the old brick or flip phone. There's something called the Lite Phone 2, which actually has a GPS map app on it. It allows you to listen to music and have podcasts and, you know, take notes and all those kind of productive digital vitamins, I guess, things that actually give you meaning. And, you know, if you could pare back your smartphone, those are the things you'd keep. We're not really seeing a huge uptake. You know, the latest stats show us that half of the Australian dumb phone users are simply people over 65 who never really took to smartphones, or just, you know, find them just not really for them. So,
although yeah. I thought it was interesting to note too that they also are possibly making a canny choice about battery life and cost, because those things are cheaper.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. That's one of the big advantages is battery life. How often do people have to be out and about and quickly search for, you know, has anyone got a charger? Has anyone got a charger? You know, vending machines selling chargers these days. But I do think that being more mindful about your smartphone use is the way to go. And the digital nutrition approach is the one that we definitely recommend. And I think that one of the biggest things is simply taking out your phone at an idle moment. That's something, you know, we find that people pick up their phone about 100 times a day on average, which when you consider the amount of waking hours, that's, you know, every 10 or 15 minutes. So the best way to break a habit is to replace it with another one. So if you can think of something else to do in those moments where you're, you know, queuing in line or waiting for your coffee, you know, take 10 deep breaths to just, you know, recenter yourself and be aware of your surroundings. Think of something else you can do, because focusing on don't pick up the phone, it's like don't think of a white elephant. It's not really the best way to go about it. The one I always come back to is taking notifications off your phone for things that you don't need to be notified about, because that's, once again, the thing that draws you in when you don't really need to be.
Yeah. So a friend of mine suggests if you're waiting in a queue, do your pelvic floor exercises, because otherwise you get to the end of the day and think, why did I not have 10 minutes to do that?
That's a great one as well. Yeah.
Yep.
So just I like to play a game called What Did We Do in 1997? That's my favorite game to play, because all of these things that we come up against, we kind of got through in life not that long ago.
That's really interesting. We did a story recently about hanging out and how people used to hang out with each other and talk and watch other people go past. And what a lovely time that was for many of us. Look, it's been fascinating looking at some of the ways that people are trying to take back that control over their attention spans and their lives and their connectivity. Thank you both so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary.
Jocelyn. Thank you. Jocelyn Brewer is a registered psychologist. She specialises in digital nutrition. And Brad Ridout is Associate Professor of Cyber Psychology at the University of Sydney. Up next on Life Matters, sticking with the weird and wonderful ways our brains work, why do we feel the way we feel about our musical idols? A look into the psychology of fan culture up next.
Hello, this is Andrew Ford. On The Music Show, we can be in Baroque Spain one moment, and the next moment hearing about gypsy jazz fusion from Brisbane. That's The Music Show with me, Andrew Ford. And if you miss us on RN weekend mornings at 11, you can catch us on the ABC Listen app in your own sweet time.
Cheering on the Matildas, dressing up to go and see Tay-Tay, breathlessly messaging each other about George Lucas's latest thought bubble. What do we get out of being a fan? Is it about escaping to another place for a while? Or does it give us a different sense of community? How far have you gone to show your love? Have you camped out all night to get tickets, or gone overseas to a convention, got a tattoo? I'm really keen to hear, too, what you get out of being a fan. Chris Cheers is with us today. He's a psychologist and the author of The New Rulebook, Notes from a Psychologist to Help Redefine the Way You Live. Chris, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Is there someone that stands out for you that you really, really, really love?
I love a few. I love Swiftie kind of as much as anyone, but I think my main love is Dolly Parton.
That's interesting. Yeah. What is it about her that speaks to you?
I just think the longevity of her career, you know, thinking 50, 60 years of writing, you know, over 5,000 songs. And what I love about Dolly is she's never really political in her statements, and we don't know much about her private life, but she expresses her life through her music, through her lyrics. So I think we all get to feel really connected to Dolly, because Dolly can kind of be whatever we need her to be. And there's always a song for every moment.
Well, and she also expresses her values through her donations, doesn't she? I mean, she gave money to COVID.
Yeah, COVID. Vaccines.
Yeah, and books.
Absolutely. She has that program where she gives books to children throughout the state, throughout America. It's she through her actions and her songs, I think, is where you really get to see the values of Dolly that I think we all really, really connect to.
She's been really interesting too, isn't she? Because she talks in a way that was pretty unusual in the 70s and 80s about being completely fine with how she looked. And that was kind of amazing to me as a young girl growing up in the country. It's like, oh, you don't care what people think of how you look.
Absolutely. Writing songs like Backwards Barbie and like embracing how she looked, you know, that old, like, you know, it takes a lot of money to look this cheap, to like own that. She was doing this in the 60s and 70s. And when you look back at some of these songs, they're about sexism and they're about mental health. And this was written at a time when, you know, a lot of people, and especially women, weren't speaking openly about this. So she's just incredible.
Yep. So when you think about how you personally feel about her, Chris, is it like this kind of lofty, distant admiration, or do you feel like you are connected to her?
You feel like you're connected because I think there are times in your life where you're struggling, and anyone who has that artist or that singer that they connect to, that they turn to certain songs or certain albums to get them through. So I think we have this sense that people are there for us when we need them, which I think really gives us this sense of connection.
So, yeah, I mean, you're talking about your relationship with Dolly, but you're a psychologist, so you know how we tick as well. Is that healthy when we form these attachments to people?
I think it's what we refer to as parasocial attachments sometimes, this sort of one-sided attachment. And I think parasocial attachments can be helpful as long as they're additive to other real-world attachments in our life as well. So as long as you've got those real-world social attachments, adding on an adoration to another, you know, singer or songwriter or star can really help you, I think, understand yourself through these songs as well.
How do you understand yourself through a performer or an artist or a, I don't know, a sports star? You know, it's interesting how we blend those different things together in the sense of our attachment to them. Perhaps you're attached to the team rather than an individual. Perhaps you're attached to a band or, you know, a TV show. The Sex and the City franchise, we will talk about that in some detail in a little while. But I know, you know, there are people who formed entire online communities around particular TV shows. The Trekkies, obviously, an example. What's yours? Who or what are you so attached to that you would maybe even go overseas or, I don't know, make some giant public commitment for? I mean, I'm a Jane Austen fan and I have seen all the shows several times and read all the books many times and chased up all the memes. Yes, sure. I don't know. I don't know that I would call myself a fan, but I really, really love her and everything she has ever written, as we chat today with Chris Cheers, who's a psychologist, who's got some personal and some professional perspectives on this too. Just before we go into parasocial relationships a bit more, you've been to Dollywood, haven't you?
I have indeed. So me and a good friend of mine, Richard, who really introduced me, and we formed, you know, this idea that you sometimes form connections over these things you love. So our connection certainly formed over a love of Dolly. And one night, you know, over a couple of whiskeys, we decided to go to Dollywood. And to our credit, the next morning, we went to a travel agent back in the days when you would do that. And we booked the flights, we flew to New York, and then we drove down through the States to eventually end up and do the pilgrimage to Dollywood. And I'll tell you, if there's something magical about someone you love so much and then there being an entire theme park dedicated to her. And I'll tell you, every staff member you meet at Dollywood has met Dolly and they love her like family. It's really palpable and a really, really special place.
That's really interesting. What would you say about the energy or the vibe at a Dolly concert? Like, because different fan bases have a different vibe, don't they?
And this is the amazing thing about a Dolly concert, which I'd recommend everyone go to if you haven't been. Because of that idea that she often doesn't say things politically openly, but maybe more so through her music, I think it means that she appeals to incredibly diverse range of people. So at a Dolly concert, you'll have kind of, you know, I'm a queer man, you know, you'll have your gays and your queers and everyone there. You'll have quite conservative sort of side of things, especially in the US. She sort of somehow manages to breach kind of that conservative and progressive sort of parts of the US.
Country music is weird, isn't it?
Right. It's so strange. But you're there and everyone just loves and you feel connected. And I think that's what's amazing about these relationships we form with stars or with singers. Is there's this common ground. And when you're in that space and you're all sharing the same love for someone, you feel more connected to the people around you.
And I really find it fascinating that she, you know, came from poverty and marginalisation, and she really brought fans from that with her and maintained her connection to them, which is something a lot of performers really struggle with, don't they? It's like, well, I'm rich and famous now, so I'm leaving you behind. Dolly didn't do that.
And still releasing music. Like, she could have given, you know, just stopped and just rested on her laurels, but she's still still releasing music, and she's still, you know, being current, and she's still there, and she's still, you know, making these connections. And I think part of it is she's really aware of the community of people that love her, and she's there for us and gives back as well.
Well, and when we talk about communities, the Elvis fan community springs to mind because it's huge, it's passionate, it's gone on for a really long time. It's very enduring. Is that you? Are you perhaps someone who takes on the suit and the hair and becomes Elvis at some point? Or do you just have, you know, a shrine to Elvis? I would really, really love to hear how you have adored that person or artist or team that you feel so connected to in your life or your house, because I'm interested in why they speak to you like that. Christina's in Melbourne. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Hilary.
Who do you love?
I love a Canadian singer-songwriter called Ferron, F-E-R-R-O-N. Her birth name is Debbie Foisey. And I met her. I love her stuff so much that I went to Saturna Island in the Gulf Islands in Canada to meet her.
Wow. And what was it about her, Christine, that made you go, this is for me?
Her songs have a particular poetry to them and really speak to the human experience. And she's well known in folk circles and women's music circles. And people continue to love her music, down the decades.
That's really interesting, isn't it, Christina, that someone can speak to you for such a long time. Why do you think that particular person really fired up your passion as opposed to lots of other musicians? I mean, there's such a huge breadth of things to listen to these days. What made you travel overseas for her?
She's an elder in her community. She's part Métis. That's one of the First Nations groups in Canada. And, her songs are just perfectly poised between the words and the music. She's a model singer-songwriter, and I don't know. There's something about her music that's just a standout for me. You know, many others have come on the scene since who are good, but her music remains. And I listen to it in the car, and I walked along paths on this sort of, not remote, but, you know, sparsely populated island. And we talked about, you know, she told me where she'd had the idea for various songs that on the goat path that she near her home. And, it's just inspirational, her work.
That's interesting too, Christina, that some people say don't meet your heroes. What's your view?
Oh, gosh. Meet your heroes, for sure, but all heroes are carbon-based life forms, and you know, everyone's human. And but meet them and just feel blessed by who they are.
Christina, just finally, are there other fans of this singer that you have come into contact with as well? Is there a fan base?
There have been various kind of groups over the years. There was a fan base of women who were attenders of the Michigan Women's Music Festival, a major music festival in North America, some of whom I met while I was on the island. There's quite a few people here in Australia who love her music. That's what I'm thinking of at the moment, not wanting to rattle on and on here on the show.
Yeah. No, that I'm very interested, and I really appreciate that you called, Christina, because I'm interested in what it's like to connect with other fans as well as to have that incredible love for the particular person yourself. So thanks for illuminating that for us, Christina.
I could just say that I first heard Ferron's music in a share house in Melbourne in the 80s, and I'm still friends with the woman whose house it was. And so bonds are long-lasting, I would have to say.
Yes, yeah, that's certainly true. Christina, thank you for your call. We're speaking with Chris Cheers too, who's a psychologist, and he's a fan himself, so he can help us illuminate some of the kind of psychological processes that happen around fandom. That was really interesting, wasn't it, what Christina was saying, that it's those songs are associated with great memories for her, but also they seem to speak to her in the present.
Yeah, well, music is a really special thing when it impacts the brain differently. We have memories, you know, we remember music differently. There's a lot of science around the impact music can have to help us, you know, make memories and also remember things, you know. So I think if you're sharing music with certain moments, with certain people, you know, it's going to impact those relationships and it's going to form part of those relationships.
I guess we have to ask too, we talked about parasocial relationships, which are basically relationships with people that we don't know. You know, we feel this connection, but they don't know us from a bar of soap. Is that always a healthy thing?
I mean, these things are sort of not black and white in terms of like healthy or unhealthy. You know, if your love for someone and your adoration for someone you don't know is meaning that you're sacrificing real relationships in your life or you're sacrificing other meaningful, you know, connections in your life, then that could be a problem. But if it is something that is, you know, your love is something that helps you connect with others, you know, or these songs help you better understand the human condition, or your love of these films help you, you know, get a better understanding of your own life, then I don't think that's ever a problem.
And you said too that sometimes, you know, you're going through a particular life event or life stage and they can really help you in that particular moment. That's a lovely thing too, isn't it?
Yeah, sometimes we don't often in life have the friends or the partners where we can openly communicate about our feelings or about what we're going through. So I think also what songs give us is this example of someone actually is going through what I'm going through, or they're giving words to my experience, which can help us make sense of ourselves.
Claire's on the Gold Coast. Hi, Claire. Who is it for you?
Hey, it's I'm an absolute Gwen Stefani from No Doubt. Tragic fan for a long time.
That's interesting that you say tragic, because it's often applied to fans, isn't it? Why do you feel that way?
Oh, it's just, I mean, it's a running joke. It's kind of been a running joke among my friends for a long time, but I mean, it's not really tragic. I love her. I think that she's great. She's always been this independent kind of just a force within music, you know. She was there when it was all dudes and she just was always herself, and I think that's why I loved her so much. And it's like, and now I've found a whole like community of pals all around the world, which is probably the best thing that I've ever gotten from my like total love of Gwen Stefani and No Doubt.
Yeah, how did you come into contact with those people, Claire?
Well, I'm showing my age. Internet forums, yep. Way back when, you know, first on the internet, you know, in chat rooms and yeah, forum boards, things like that. And then we'd moved throughout the years. You know, we now have like there's like a Facebook group that we're in. We actually have like a WhatsApp, a WhatsApp chat that a few of us are in, and we've got. I've got some friends that are in Sydney, some in Melbourne. A few Dutch friends, an English friend, and I actually, I was telling the producer, I actually went to Holland in 2019 and I met one of them and hung out and stayed at their place and met her family. So, you know, it has like real world connections as well.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I was thinking about Gwen Stefani and how she, like, she did have these boots and she would stomp through and just go, I don't care, I'm going to do my thing. But she seemed like she was having fun too, didn't she, Claire?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was this, like, that mix of she's so feminine but had this total brashness and didn't buy into that either. But, you know, I think the interesting thing, like growing up with her in some ways, like she's older than I am, but it was I've come to realise the more I've listened to her music and the more I've kind of read interviews and just watched her that actually there's this deep kind of vanity that she has, and it's sort of then that, you know, making those sort of connections that she was this strong kind of emblem, but in actual fact, there's lots of really, yeah, she's quite a vain, vulnerable person.
So. Yeah, gee, a star, who would have thought?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that Claire said to me, stuck out, Chris Cheers, that, you know, that word tragic, oh, she's a tragic fan. Is it that we feel like it's a bit not cool to be so enthusiastic about something?
I think we do, yeah, almost compensate because we don't feel comfortable saying maybe how much we love these people or what we do for these people.
But that is a genuine love.
But it's a genuine love underneath it, I think. And that's the beauty of meeting other people who share the same love, is because suddenly you don't have to apologize for it. You don't have to apologize for, you know, everything you bought on eBay over the years or every trip you've made for this person because, you know, these people, this community understands you.
Yeah, one trip to Dollywood, that's nothing.
nothing.
Ryan's got something to say about that idea that, you know, it's not all sunshine and roses. Ryan from Brisbane, hello.
My story sort of starts in the early 80s when I was about 10 and I fell in love with this singer, which I don't expect many of your listeners to remember, named Lloyd Cole.
I know Lloyd Cole. Perfect Skin.
Yeah, that's him. That's him. And, you know, for the next 20 years, I was kind of pretty convinced that Lloyd was writing every song for me and navigating every relationship I ever had and so forth. In early days of the internet, I tracked him down. I even like own his golf putter. And anyway, I was obsessed with Lloyd. And when he eventually, I eventually saw him, I was 30, before I first saw him in Australia and sort of followed him around the country. And it was mainly full of other 30-year-old men who knew every word, with their wives that didn't know any. And then, you know, the second or third time that he came out, you know, I was sort of now sort of 40 odd. And I kind of realized that I didn't really like him, like as a person, you know,
okay.
His interaction with the audience and his tone and it sort of, it kind of shattered, you know, this sort of 30 years of being so connected with someone. It was a sort of sad ending in a way.
That's, yeah. I mean, are you still able to enjoy the music, Ryan, or has it kind of soured it for you?
It's funny. I now will put it on once a year just to reminisce, but it's not something I listen to regularly anymore, even though, you know, I used to listen to it every day as a teenager.
Well, do you think that's because it's now got those less positive associations, or just that musically you've grown and you like different things?
Yeah, I think that's probably it. Like, I think we all evolve and change, and musical tastes sort of evolve. But I also think, like, certain musicians, what you're sort of talking about today is they have a real role in our lives, you know, outside, and particularly pre-internet, you know, where we had this one thing we held on to and we sort of owned in
mm-hmm.
a way.
Yep.
And now I don't know. I don't know what it's like to be a teenager. I've got teenagers, but I don't see that sort of soul obsession in my kids as much. But I'm sure it still exists.
That's great, Ryan. Thanks so much for walking us through that, because you've touched on a few things that people clearly resonate with. That thing that Ryan said about, you know, falling out of love with your heroes. And a lot of people feel, for example, that even though they passionately adored Michael Jackson's music, that since the abuse allegations came out, they cannot listen to it. Morrissey, you know, if you loved him in your dark goth days, maybe you feel a bit uncomfortable with some of his political statements now. How do you approach that?
Well, it's basically, we're talking here about when parasocial relationships start to become a bit less one-sided. So if you go to the concert of someone, or if you hear someone talk in an interview, you're actually getting to know them a little bit more, them not getting to know you. But it can add this information that suddenly, you know, I think when a lot of stars who aren't really presenting themselves much, like, as I said, Dolly, Beyonce is another good example. They don't often, you know, we think they're being authentic and genuine, but they're often not revealing much about themselves at all. And in that space, we can put whatever we need psychologically. You know, if we need them to be a strong person who's made it through a breakdown, you know, we can see that, or whatever we need them to be, we can really insert into that space. So when we start to know more and more about them through interviews or things that come out later in life, it kind of destroys that. Suddenly we can't just make them whatever we want them to be. And that can be a real grieving process for people, because suddenly this relate, you know, and it is a real relationship, you know, sometimes the relationships we form with these songs and the special kind of connection we have, it can feel like a real grieving process when, you know, I think as that caller connected to, when suddenly this person isn't who you thought they'd be.
Or who you wanted them to be.
Mm.
Would you ever break up with Dolly? What would it take?
Oh, I don't think. I mean, it would take a lot. I think I'm one of those people that would be able to, even if she said something, I'd be able to talk my way through why she didn't really mean it at the time. But
okay, I am a psychologist, but I'm just going to kind of push that to one side.
But I'll tell you what, one thing that comes to mind, though, is I hope it never happens, but if she does pass away, that is something I actually do think about.
You hope it never, you hope she's cryogenically frozen.
I would love that. I mean, if anyone's going to do it, maybe it's Dolly. But I think that will actually be, and this is something else to consider, is it is a real grieving process when we do lose these people, you know, and whoever that singer or actor is for you, that I think we need to sometimes honour those grief processes more than we really do.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. I still remember waking up and hearing that Kurt Cobain had died. And, you know, I really loved Nirvana at the time, but also happened to be writing my honours thesis on representations of celebrity in the media. I was like, oh, well, there's chapter four.
That's convenient.
Interesting. Yeah, I know. Sorry, Kurt. I, you know, obviously I grieved first. But you mentioned too that that line between kind of authenticity and what happens online on social media. I mean, is that different from what used to happen in newsletters that the PR people just churn stuff out, or is it kind of ramped up?
I think social media has impacted it because we now have this sense that we feel like, you know, if you're following someone on Instagram, we feel like it's them that is writing their posts or them that, but often, you know, it's not, you know, it's some sort of machine or, you know, other person behind that. But it doesn't matter. We can now make this connection that we feel is even truer, or we feel is even more authentic because of that Instagram post or whatever it might be on social media. So I think social media has really changed the landscape, because maybe there's not such a space anymore where we can insert our version of the person, because maybe we're actually being told a certain version of this person. And, you know, I'm no celebrity, I'm no star. But I think there is a process of putting a certain kind of authenticity out in the world that maybe is a bit more constructed than we kind of consider when we're sitting at home just loving this person.
Yeah, though surely we have learned something from the Kardashians over the last few decades. Chris Cheers is our guest. He's a psychologist and he's helping us look at some of the exciting and fascinating questions and discussions around fandom. Michelle is in Sydney. Michelle, it's your daughter that's got the passion. Who's she attached to?
Oh, hello. My daughter has been completely obsessed by the boys from One Direction since, I suppose, she was about 10. And so it's been going for 14 years. And I think it's fair to say that it's actually had a really negative impact on my family's life, because
wow,
everything stops if one of them comes to Australia, she will leave whatever she has to do. She'll live outside the hotel. She goes to the airport. She travels around the country. Nothing will stop her. I think it's, I don't know, she has an intellectual disability. I think a lot of the kids or young people that hang around these boys do. And I wonder if it's about sort of a friendship. They can find friendship quite difficult. And so she spends hours every day watching videos of them, listening to the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah, Michelle, I've noticed that with One Direction fans, there doesn't seem to be any middle ground. You're either, you don't really care, or you're up to 11 with the dial.
Yeah.
Does your daughter connect to any other fans, or is this a kind of internal adoration?
No, she talks about the fans, and there's a group, I think, that she talks with, but I'm not really sure how real they are either. It's a really odd thing. We've travelled a bit, and we were in London a few years ago, and she spent the entire time talking about going to Wolverhampton, which is where one of the boys is from, and looking at the school. So we made the trek 2 hours up to Wolverhampton in -3 degrees to look at his school. She's been to Niles Village in Ireland. It's like her whole world is about these boys.
Does it make her happy, Michelle? Do you feel ultimately she's enjoying it?
I worry. She loves them. I think it's comforting when they're not in everyday life. When she watches these videos over and over and over again, I think it gives her comfort. Is she happy? I think, I don't know. She wants to be with the fans all the time. She wants to be with them all the time. So I don't know that makes her happy.
Yeah, that's interesting. Michelle, I'm going to put that to Chris. Thank you so much for sharing that. As I was listening to you talk, I was thinking about my little boy who has an intellectual disability and is just driving me nuts listening to the same Ed Sheeran songs over and over again.
Oh my God. 14 years, Hillary, good luck.
He's just started puberty. I cannot wait. Thank you, Michelle. Chris, that's an interesting situation, isn't it? It's like there's joy and there is connection where connection might be harder in other situations. How should Michelle manage that?
I think it's interesting to note the age here. So adolescents, children, these kind of connections can be stronger, or maybe kids and adolescents, because their brain is still developing, their sense of identity is still developing, that their ability to have self-awareness of the impact this is having on their family, or children brains are pretty egotistical, kind of at a neurobiological level.
It's like teenagers go back to being toddlers, isn't it?
Exactly.
And in the center of my world.
So the impact it's having on your own life or on your family, you may not be as, aware of at that age. So I think it is really challenging for parents to find out where that line is. You do want to support your kids to, follow their interests, and that might lead to connections and real social connections that you want to honour. It's the same with online social connections. I think, some parents have a difficulty kind of understanding that online connections are real connections and are really important connections sometimes for their kids. So it's sort of about monitoring that and understanding that. But at the same time, you do want to try and, be there to teach your children or teach the adolescents, as hard as it is, to notice that if this, obsession, we might call it, when I use that word purposely, when something that we love starts to interfere with other meaningful, important things in our life. And I think the only thing you can do as a parent is just keep having those conversations to help, as your teenager, their brain develops and they grow, to start to see, well, is this having a good impact on my life or not? And to be able to develop that capacity for themselves.
Well, we talked before too about certain communities being drawn to particular stars, and I'm wondering too if some performers can provide a safe space, like that fan group can be somewhere you can express yourself if you don't feel connected to other people where you live.
Whoever your artist is, I think the most important part of the fandom, I'm a psychologist, so I'm always going to care more about real life social connection. So I think as long as your fandom leads to that real life sense of belonging, or whether it's online or in person, I think that's when those social connections are really giving you something. That's when it's important. The unfortunate thing is where that connection goes sometimes can be unhelpful depending on the actions that you might do with that group. But you do need to, you need that social connection. So I think there's always this kind of downplay of like, what am I sacrificing to be part of this group? And sometimes we have to have those hard conversations with ourselves.
Raina from Mornington. This isn't one we haven't covered before. Raina, tell us.
I'm a great fan of Marilyn Monroe and have been basically all my adult life. I've read everything I can possibly read about her and always admired her acting and her ability to be vulnerable and a fantastic talent at the same time. And I was really involved in theatre, so I actually did perform Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend by Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, the movie. And, I loved it. It was great fun and just, I don't know, I felt like I was just, it was honouring her.
Yep. It's been really interesting, hasn't it, Raina, to see people talking more in recent decades about how she was smart and read books and as well as just looked amazing.
Yeah, she was very intelligent and a thirst for learning. And if you look at her movies now, she is a very good actress, I still talk about the present. That's scary.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, it's an eternal present. It's present for you, isn't it?
Yeah, and I guess because she died so young, she didn't actually live to lose her beauty or her charisma or whatever she had. So that was I enjoyed doing it. It was fun.
Chris, I have to quickly finally ask you about Sex and the City. You started a group watching group.
Yeah, in the deep, dark lockdown number, well, I don't even
remember. Whatever, 78.
A friend decided, I noticed that if we watched one episode every day, we would by make it to the end of lockdown. So we watched it, we started a WhatsApp group, we watched an episode every day, and we're still, I mean, we are persevering within Just Like That, like many people out there, because I think it's not the show, it's that community around that we talk about. And we talk about this show, you know, that love-hate thing, I think is what makes these communities so special.
Psychologist Chris Cheers, helping us understand the psychology of fandom. Next time on Life Matters, the boomer generation pretty much kick-started the whole backpacking movement in the 60s and 70s. But how does the travel industry treat that generation now? Some hotels won't accept bookings from people over 65. And once you turn 70, you might find your travel insurance skyrockets. Is the travel industry ageist? And what opportunities exist for players willing to embrace inclusive tourism? Join Ange Caterns, filling in for me then.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.